Hello and welcome to another episode of Talk About Tomorrow, the Futurist podcast with me, Tom Cheesewright. This week, as usual, two stories for you. First, about our population, its rise and fall, and second, about the difference between humans and robots when it comes to work. The population implosion. Every year, the UN updates its forecasts for the global population. In 2019, the median prediction saw us hitting a peak of around 11 billion humans at the end of this century, before our numbers start to decline. 11 billion is a lot of humans. The planet could easily support that many if we all adopted certain lifestyles and policies. But not if everyone wants to live like people do in Britain or America. And there's a good argument that says, why shouldn't they? After all, we have spent decades squandering the planet's resources to feed ourselves and our economies. With this as the target standard of living, 11 billion people on the planet was always going to be tough. Not only would it accelerate climate change, feeding that many people would be made harder by its effects. But at least we could see the population peaking, and we could begin to plan for its decline. The problem with a declining population is that, global disasters aside, it generally means a fall in the birth rate. That means that the population is ageing as it shrinks, which in turn means fewer young and working age people are available to support the older members of the population, either through taxes or through direct support. Nonetheless, given the pressures of climate change and the reasons why the population was peaking, rising global wealth and the emancipation and education of women, it was clearly a good thing. And while some countries where the birth rate is already low were starting to struggle with an ageing population, at a global scale it was something we had decades to learn how to deal with. Then came a new report. This report from the University of Washington's Institute for Health Metrics and Evaluation shows the global population peaking lower and sooner. Instead of 2100, it will peak in 2064. And instead of 11 billion, it will peak at 9.7 billion. The global fertility rate will be down to 1.7 by the end of the century. What does this mean? Well, let's start with the good news. It means women around the world have more power and control over reproduction. And while this is probably too little, too late to have any real impact on catastrophic climate change, it will reduce the scale of the mitigation challenge. A rather euphemistic way of talking about the feeding and rehousing of millions of people. Bad news? The population implosion is happening much faster than we thought at a global scale. Here in the UK, the effects aren't predicted to be that dramatic in terms of total population, but some countries like Italy, Spain and Portugal are predicted to see their populations halve by 2100. This will see a collapse in the tax base and workforce, while the cost of caring for an ageing population rises and rises. And it starts now. So what do we do? The first response to this population implosion must be to shore up programmes that support women's education, work and reproductive rights. As the economic consequences of this population decline become clear, there are bound to be those whose solution is to drive women back to a role as mother and homemaker. Setting the policy tone now by addressing the remaining imbalances will make the coming battles much easier. Then we need to look at relatively short-term measures to our ageing population. Immigration is the most obvious solution, politically unpopular as it is in many places right now. Populations in India and Nigeria will continue to grow through the end of the century. Rather than closing our doors, we should be opening them and inviting people in. Based on this report, it seems many countries are likely to incentivize immigration within a few decades. Technology will play a huge role. There is a lot of squeamishness about robots and automation in care and health contexts, as I've spoken about before. But technology can alleviate the burden of some routine and unskilled tasks from care workers, giving them more time to offer personal contact and companionship. Public health campaigns will also be critical. If we can help people to look after their own health and extend people's healthy, productive years by 1, 2, or even 5 on average, then we can drastically reduce costs to the state. This is likely to be married to an extension to the working age. Don't expect your pension before 70 or even 75, so staying healthy as long as possible will be critical. The longer-term question becomes one of species survival. With a birth rate at 1.7, the population will continue to shrink. Will we see it return to more sustainable levels around 2.1? I think we will. There is an element of techno-optimism in this view, but I do believe that perhaps in the next century we will reach a level of global health and wealth where most of us are living much longer, healthier lives, with average lifespans rising over 100. If you think that this is overly optimistic, just look at changes in the last century. Investments in women's medicine should see the trauma and risk of childbirth reduced over this period. Greater political equalisation at home and in the workplace should make it easier for women to have children without damaging their careers. And with better medicine and extended lifespans, having children later in life will be more common. The population is likely to decline a long way before any of this happens. We may find we settle in the 5 to 6 billion range before it does. And post-climate change, the world will look very different then. Robots don't take jobs. There is one characteristic that is more important than any other in humanising the robots we see in science fiction films. It's not the oversized eyes of Wall-E, or the cute little beeps of R2-D2, or the conversational humour of Johnny Five. It is their ability to adapt to different challenges and situations. This adaptability is what separates the robots of science fiction from the robots of reality. In the real world, we tend to build robots for single tasks. We design them to perform those tasks with incredible efficiency. Inside the bounds of these narrowly defined tasks, they can outperform humans by many orders of magnitude in speed, strength, and dexterity. Beyond these narrowly defined tasks, though, they are useless, unless and until they can be reconfigured for the next challenge. Building flexibility into robots is expensive, both mechanically and computationally. This is why the robots of science fiction are so different and so appealing. R2 can deliver cocktails, hack space stations, fix your space fighter, and even hold down a conversation, if you speak robot whistle. Meanwhile, his real-world counterpart can just move steel pressings from one place to another, over and over and over again. This differentiation is critical in understanding the impact of robots on the future workforce. Because there is no robot today that is a straight swap for a human being. When we employ a human in a job, we count on a degree of flexibility and an array of complementary skills. They must be able to understand variations in the brief and respond to them. They must be able to access the task location. They must be able to communicate with the other human beings around that task, customers, colleagues, partners. We do think about these things when we recruit a person for a role. But a lot of the basic skills they require are just part of being human. They are not part of being a robot. So when robots enter the workforce, while they absolutely displace people, it is never a one-to-one ratio. Rather, the workload of specific tasks is aggregated from multiple people and allocated to one robot. One machine might do 80% of the work of 10 different people. That still leaves work for 2 full-time people, but it is now a pair of roles that look very different to before. Sometimes these new roles will be very high value. For example, in a professional services environment, the robot might do a lot of the document processing that has traditionally been the domain of junior members of staff. What is left is the strategic thinking, problem solving, and client engagement. Sometimes what is left might be less engaging. Picture the delivery driver in a self-driving van who just has to get out at the relevant locations and run the parcel to the door, or as is so often the case, throw it over a fence or put it in the paper recycling bin. Of course, you don't have to use a human to round out the robot's capabilities. You can always change the operating model. In the delivery example, the robot truck is more likely to park up outside and phone the recipient to tell them to come out to collect their parcel. It won't need to put things in odd places because it is in permanent communication with the recipient's smart device and knows their location and availability. The net result is likely to be that the perceived value of humans in the full-time workforce increases. Because humans do the low-volume, high-value tasks that machines find difficult. This won't, sadly, overcome our historical underpayment of those in roles like care and teaching. Though the same automation effects may free more of their time to focus on the aspects of the job where they add the most value and relieve some of the time pressure. Alongside the rising perceived value of human work, it is hard to see anything but a decline in the total number of traditional full-time jobs. Jobs that are a mutual contract between an employer and employee, trading commitment for security and personal development. Though the statistic about 65% of future jobs not being invented yet seems to be itself completely invented, there will undoubtedly be new jobs created in the future. But it is hard to see what jobs might be created that offer large numbers of people long-term security. This is because of the way that current generations of automation technology differ from previous generations. First, though specialised, today's robots absolutely can take on cognitive tasks. Second, the cost of tailoring a machine to a specific task is much lower than it has been, especially where those tasks are cognitive and can be replicated in software. It's hard to see new work being created that can't itself be undertaken 80% by robots. The jobs that remain will be of higher value and, on average, higher pay. The people who don't get those jobs? There will be the same spread there is now amongst the self-employed and gig economy workers. Many with high value skills will be absolutely fine. But the size of the precariat in less secure freelance and part-time work could grow considerably. Robots don't take jobs, but they do take work. And in doing so, they may widen the economic divisions in society. That's it for this episode of Talk About Tomorrow, the Futurist podcast with me, Tom Cheesewright. Thank you for listening. Please do leave a review wherever you got this podcast. They really help and they're much, much appreciated. They make my day sometimes. If you like this, then please do go and check out my two books. High Frequency Change, my first book about why so many of us feel like change happens faster now. And a very practical book, Future Proof Your Business, how to build the principles of futurism into your working life. Thanks again for listening. Bye-bye.